This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. March Madness is upon us. Over the coming weeks, brackets will be busted by, among other things, shots from the free throw line. But our first story this week is not about one of those free throw attempts. It's about one that mattered a great deal more. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Chris Street grew up in a small southern Iowa town called Humiston. He was an all-around athlete. But Chris's parents, Mike and Patty, knew their son's number one sport was basketball.
Because when he would get done with football, then he would even come home and shoot hoops on the driveway.
He must have had a lot of energy.
Yeah, he did. Absolutely.
I was actually hoping he'd pursue the baseball so then we could have our winters to go hunt and fish and stuff. But
Instead, the winners were all about basketball, especially when the Iowa Hawkeyes were on TV.
Of course, when there was going to be a game, I mean, he was thinking about that the whole day.
Chris eventually grew to 6'8" and got really good at basketball. In 1988, during Chris's sophomore year of high school and just before his 16th birthday, an envelope showed up at the Street's home. It was a recruiting letter from Iowa.
So we actually hid it from him and framed it. And for his birthday present, we give it to him.
And I wrapped it.
And so that was a big event for everybody.
That summer, Iowa offered Chris a scholarship. He committed the next day.
Slicing through the lane and setting up Street.
Chris Street became a starter, averaging more than 10 points and 8 rebounds a game. But there was one area he knew he could improve.
Going into his junior year, he was upset that he missed some free throws, I think, and he decided to set his goal that he was not going to miss a Big Ten free throw. That was his goal.
That next season, Chris made free throw after free throw, and he started approaching Iowa's school record of 33 straight, which had stood for 24 years. When the Hawkeyes visited Duke in mid-January, Chris's streak was at 32. His parents watched from home.
CBS Sports welcomes you to the...
How are you both feeling going into that game?
Nervous.
Late in the first half, Chris drew a foul and went to the line for 2 shots.
First one went in pretty good.
That ties the school record.
And the second one kind of rattled around a little bit, but once it went in, the house kind of exploded.
We exploded.
We were very excited for that.
We were ecstatic for him.
Yeah.
Just ecstatic for him.
After the game, Patty left a message at her son's apartment.
Telling him how proud we were of him and congratulations, but I never did get to talk to him.
3 nights after Chris set the record, on January 19th, 1993, Patty was closing up the family's mom-and-pop convenience store when her husband showed up.
I knew something was wrong when he came. And he said, "It's Christopher." And I said, "Oh, did he blow out a knee?" Because I thought, oh, he blew out a knee, you know. And Mike says that he told me, but I did not listen. I wouldn't listen.
Chris's car had collided with a snowplow. Chris was pronounced dead at the scene. Patty went home. The news started to sink in.
I knew he was in heaven. There was no doubt in my mind. He was up there. And that was such a reassuring thought.
In the weeks after Chris's death, Mike and Patty attended some of Iowa's home games. They wanted to be there to support Chris's teammates. But eventually they stopped going. It was too painful.
It just brought back too many memories, I guess, and that he's not here, you know, with us.
Years went by. Mike and Patty stayed away from Hawkeyes games, but they were grateful for Chris's consecutive free throw record.
It was very special because, you know, as a parent who's lost a child, you don't want people to forget him. And I guess with that record, it was just another thing to remind people not to forget him.
A decade passed, then another decade. Chris Street's free throw streak remained in the Iowa record book.
I remember Coach Close saying that he didn't think it'd ever be broke.
On June 19th, 1997, 4 years after Chris Street's death, Jordan Bohannon was born in Iowa City. He was the youngest of 4 boys.
Well, I definitely ended up on the ground a lot when I was a child. Sometimes, I swear, I'd be just laying in my bed and my brothers would come in and just tackle me.
Jordan's father had played football at the University of Iowa, but basketball was the sport for the Bohannon boys. Jordan's three older brothers all played Division I. Unhappily for Jordan's dad, none of them ended up at Iowa. When Jordan played two-on-two with his siblings, he was not only the youngest, he was also the shortest. But he found a way to be competitive.
The only way for me to get some shots up was just keep backing up and backing up until they were just tired and they didn't want to keep stepping out farther. So I guess that's where I got some of my shooting abilities.
As a senior in high school, Jordan hit 43% of his three-pointers and 92% of his free throws. His dream was to play for Iowa. So when the Hawkeyes coach called to offer him a scholarship, Jordan accepted that same night. Before Jordan Bohannon's freshman season in 2016, there was a team banquet. That's when he met Mike and Patty Street. They'd started attending Hawkeyes games again.
Talked to them a little bit, and obviously I knew a little bit about Chris, but I wanted to learn more.
There just seemed to be an instant bond, actually.
There was. He's this warm kid.
And the more Jordan spoke with the Streets, the more he realized how much he and Chris had in common.
It's kind of that weird spiritual connection that I've had with him.
He just seems caring, just by the way he carries himself. You know, maybe he doesn't smile all the time, but boy, when he does, it just makes me want to squeeze him more when I hug him.
Yeah, she's a huge hugger.
And then this past January, Chris Street's free throw record started to face a serious threat.
And there's number 30, Bohannon. Two more in the well, Iowa by...
You know, we, of course, we were watching it close. It was one of these feelings that I had. I wanted him to break it because he's such a good person, good Hawkeye family person. We always said, who better to break it, you know, than Jordan?
And we'd had 25 years, and I guess that I just kind of thought, well, maybe we've had our time.
But yet at the same time, as a mom, you'd like for your own child to keep it too. So it was just a flip-flop there for me anyway.
In mid-February, Jordan Bohannon hit his 31st and 32nd straight free throws. A little over a week later, Iowa hosted Northwestern in the final home game of the season. Mike and Patty Street were in the stands. Late in the first half, Jordan tied the record. And then with 2 minutes and 15 seconds left in the game and the Hawkeyes leading by 8 points, Jordan Bohannon went back to the free throw line with the chance to break Chris Street's record.
We were ready to give it up, I guess.
There's a chance for Jordan Bohannon to become the all-time consecutive made free throw shooter.
I think Patty said, here we go.
I think I did say that, didn't I? Here we go.
He's made 34 straight. And he does miss it. So he does not break the Chris Street record.
Jordan's shot clanged off the front of the rim. Mike and Patty say they were shocked.
Patty looked at me and said, "Do I do that on purpose?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so."
But after the game ended, the Streets learned the truth. For the previous few weeks, Jordan had been planning to miss his 35th free throw. He explained why after the game.
Yeah, obviously that's not my record to have, and obviously that record deserves to stay in his name.
Jordan, you shouldn't have done that for, you know, Christopher. You shouldn't have done that. You know, that's what I kept telling myself. But then as you have time to think, and you're like, wow, what an incredible act of respect and kindness.
The Iowa Hawkeyes didn't make this year's NCAA tournament. Their season's over. But when Jordan Bohannon and the Hawkeyes take the floor next fall, Mike and Patty Street will be in the stands to cheer them on.
It just brings back a lot of good memories now, and it's not the hurt. So in that respect, it's wonderful.
Our story was produced by Only a Game's Martin Kessler. It's time for three stories you should know. We've got a pair of college basketball stories this week. I'm joined by The Ringer's Kevin Clark and SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me back.
In an article for ESPN's The Undefeated this week, Jesse Washington has pointed out that although most of the competitors at the accomplished D1 men's basketball teams are African American, one group of players remains predominantly white. He's referring to walk-ons. These are guys who don't get athletic scholarships, but they sit at the end of the bench, and every once in a while they go in during a blowout and score a basket, and everybody gets excited. Why are walk-ons so often white? Washington cites economics. He says they're able to afford to attend school without a scholarship. And Washington quotes one of the black coaches who says, white coaches, and last season 75% of men's D1 coaches were white, that those coaches may have a tendency to subconsciously choose individuals that are like themselves. One of the white walk-ons, a guy at Purdue, has said, no, this is great. I meet lots of important people, and I'm going to get a great job after I graduate because the coaches will help me out. I don't know what we can do about this beyond working to increase opportunities for minorities in all areas, but maybe one of you has a more specific suggestion.
I think that with college sports, it is such a way to further your career afterwards. You know, everyone wants to hire someone who, like, oh, wow, you know, you played basketball at Purdue. It doesn't matter if you saw, like, 2 minutes of a game. It's still a thing where, especially hiring managers who often probably are men, are like, oh, sick. That's awesome.
Nice imitation. Done, by the way.
That's my hiring manager.
I'm
available if anyone wants to book me for stand-up. No, but I think it's sort of a holistic solution where you need to make sure that you have other people in the room who might not look like you. And I think that's true across the board and in all industries.
You know, the NFL had a similar problem where it was sort of a network of predominantly white coaches meeting predominantly white young people, and then they start promoting them and getting them through the ranks. And they started the Bill Walsh Diversity Fellowship Program, which was just basically any person of color could apply to get a low-level position at the NFL when they're young or after their playing days are over. And really, you just start getting exactly what is needed, which is entry-level minority candidates who then can work their way up.
One of the coaches quoted in that Washington article says, why do you think all the coaches are white? They're coming up through the ranks of those guys who walk on, who have plenty of time to watch great basketball and hence develop wonderful coaching instincts. Charlotte, I understand you have a confession to make this week.
Ugh, yeah. I wasn't going to do this, but I might as well just put it all out there. I like Duke basketball. Ugh. I mean, no one likes Duke basketball. And watching March Madness for me, I've always gotten excited when they've done well. And it's a weird situation because, you know, I didn't go to Duke. I couldn't have gotten into Duke if I'd tried. But a bigger sports fandom thing that this speaks to is how being a sports fan is as much about hating something as it is about loving something. And, you know, you can love your team, but hating the rivals, like, I hate the Yankees so much, and it brings me such pleasure to hate the Yankees. Hmm. And so I understand that Duke is the villain. And they have the most hated players in college basketball constantly. Grayson Allen currently holds that title. But I do think that sort of owning the fact that I like this hated team was a little bit hard for me. I used to be embarrassed by it. Now I'm all in. I can't fight it anymore. And I'm going to go public with that.
I'm with you, Charlotte. Sports is about hate. I mean, it's so funny to me.
Kevin.
When I became a sports journalist, most of my allegiances faded to teams. But some of the teams I hated when I wasn't a journalist, I still hate. So I think hate can outstrip love in a lot of ways in sports. It's very beautiful.
I know people like hating the Yankees, and I have lived in the Boston area for a very long time, and I know I'm supposed to hate the Yankees. But I knew Yogi Berra a little bit, and I knew Joe Torre a little bit, and I couldn't hate those guys.
Right. But that's the thing, right? Like, I don't hate Aaron Judge. I don't hate Giancarlo Stanton. Like, I love those guys, but as a team, I can still, you know, hold on to that.
And the idea of the Yankees.
Yes, the idea of the Yankees and that sort of primal, ugh.
There it is again, that
there
sound.
There it is. I need to stop. I probably need to stop making that sound. I'm going to work on that.
Kevin, what have you got for us?
Well, I think one of the most important days in the history of modern football happened this week when Kirk Cousins signed a fully guaranteed 3-year, $86 million contract. Now, this is the norm in every other sport, fully guaranteed money, financial security, but you have to understand that in football, typically about half to 60% of the contracts for the absolute superstars are guaranteed, and in many cases, no money is guaranteed. And basically, Kirk Cousins spent 2.5 years plotting to get this contract. And it's the first of its kind, obviously. And if you look at the next wave of quarterback negotiations, Aaron Rodgers is coming up soon. Matt Ryan from Atlanta is coming up soon. They might ask for these sort of guarantees. And then the entire game changes. Does that trickle down to lesser known quarterbacks? Does that trickle down to non-quarterbacks? And so it could end up being that Kirk Cousins, and this is no overstatement, one of the most important players in NFL history because he changed the labor market that much.
I think that it does change the sport. I also can't imagine what's going to happen when Rodgers is up or when Matt Ryan is up because these guys are better than Cousins. And, you know, like what do you do when you have to guarantee that much more money? And what does that do for the rest of the team and the rest of the cash that you've left for players?
What I would like to see, since you're talking about contracts that would change the game entirely, I would like to see a contract where a team guarantees that it will take care of whatever medical issues a player encounters throughout his life, including care in the home for ALS and consequences of assumptive CTE. Kevin, will we see a contract like that in my lifetime?
So, unfortunately, the teams have pushed that. First of all, you know, since the new CBA happened, there is better after-career medical care for players. But for the sort of late-in-life CTE, ALS-type treatment, a lot of that has been pushed towards the concussion settlement, which was initially $760 million and has risen considerably. However, it's basically a nightmare of red tape right now. And so teams are going to push that off and say, hey, the league already settled that, go through the settlement. But the settlement at this point isn't good enough just administratively.
Still, it would be great if one player with the kind of influence that it would take would be able to get a contract like that, because that really might change things.
No doubt. And it will take someone better than Cousins to change that. I mean, that would have to be Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady saying, okay, I'm not going to play unless you guarantee me this.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Ringer's Kevin Clark and SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder. Thank you, both of you.
Oh, just a delight, Bill. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. The time has come for me to thank another listener for another Apple Podcasts review. But, you know, I'm tired today, and I think I'll ask my friend Kelvin Brooks to do it. Kelvin?
I enjoy this podcast because it reminds me that sport extends beyond the big money star adoration world of pro and college sports to include ordinary people whose accomplishments could not have been foreseen. And, as in The Wizard of Oz, draws back the curtain of myth manufactured by the publicity machines that spin our interpretation of people and events.
Thank you, Kelvin, and thanks to Barry the K and everyone who's left a review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. They really do help other listeners to find our show.
You want another read? No.
I'm Bill Littlefield.
It started kind of a slow afternoon at the Times-Picayune.
Actually, this story started well before that slow afternoon, which was in 1990. But photographer Ted Jackson's part in the story started that day in New Orleans, and for him, the story's still in progress.
My photo editor had noticed some homeless men had set up a small camp under the bridge and thought it might make an interesting story, and so I drove by and parked my car and walked, quarter of a mile or so into the space under the bridge there.
And this is under the interstate, right?
It's under the interstate, under the I-10 near Carrollton Avenue.
When Ted Jackson got to the camp under the bridge, he discovered that he'd arrived too late for the photo he'd imagined.
It was all torn up, turned upside down, the couches and chairs that had kind of formed a living room setting, which is what made it interesting, was just all wrecked.
Ted turned around to head back to his car, and then he noticed a man asleep on a rusty box spring. He was covered in a plastic sheet. Beside him was that day's paper. Ted took a picture of the man, and then he woke him up.
And I asked him if he knew what had happened, and he said, yeah, some kids were driving by, and they were shooting their guns into the camp and had run everybody off. But then we talked about journalism. He wanted to know why I cared. And talked about my editor's idea. And then he picked up the newspaper and he says, you know, the series that you guys are doing now, about, you know, life after the NFL, what happened to the heroes. He said, you ought to do a story about me. And and so I simply said, you know, and why would I want to do that? And he said, because I've played in 3 Super Bowls.
The claim seemed unlikely, and Ted Jackson was inclined to shrug it off. The man on the box spring was in a bad way, as Ted puts it. Maybe it was drugs or alcohol. Maybe he was delusional. But Ted Jackson's a newspaper man, so when he got back to the office, he stuck his head into the sports department and asked, any of you guys ever heard of Jackie Wallace? And they had. The reporters told him Wallace, a local guy, had been drafted out of the University of Arizona by the Vikings, and that he'd played for the Rams and the Colts, though in 2 Super Bowls rather than 3. Then, they said, Jackie Wallace had dropped off the map.
And nobody knows where he is. He's disappeared.
What fun you must have had saying, I do.
Oh, my goodness. I kind of looked around. I said, I think I know where he is. And I still didn't realize the gravity of what I had found.
Ted Jackson also failed to realize how the story of Jackie Wallace would come to dominate his days for years to come. He couldn't have realized it then, but he knew he had a story, and he had a photograph in which a guy who'd played in 2 Super Bowls had turned up asleep on a rusty box spring.
As a journalist, you always think that your stories may make a difference, and this one I thought would. I just didn't know it would be that dramatic. His ex-teammates and coaches found him under the bridge, you know, really quickly and hustled him off to a rehab clinic in Baltimore. But he told me that for the first day or so, he wandered the streets making sure everybody knew that the guy in the newspaper was him. He was excited that his story had made the paper.
Baltimore's a long way from New Orleans. As far as Ted and his partner, reporter Jimmy Smith, were concerned, once Jackie Wallace was off the street, the story they'd written had ended.
It was 3 years later when I was typing captions at my desk at the Times-Picayune that I heard a rap on the glass right above my desk that separates the photo department from the newsroom. I looked up and it was Jackie standing there in a 3-piece suit and he stretched out his arms wide as he was tall and just grinned and said, do you believe in miracles? He had talked his way into the newsroom to invite Jimmy and me to his wedding.
Though he didn't make the ceremony, Ted did make a trip to Baltimore shortly afterward. He met Mrs. Wallace. He accompanied Jackie to the Baltimore Arena where he was working, and together they visited the employee locker room.
That seemed to be the centerpiece of his tour. And he couldn't wait to open up the locker and show me his folder of the photos that I shot under the bridge. And he said, every day when I come to work, every day I have to open that folder and look at them and touch the pictures and remind myself that it only takes one slip and I end up right back under the bridge.
Jackie told Ted that since he'd seen the photos, he felt he'd been reborn. For years after that day in the locker room in the Baltimore Arena, on every Thanksgiving Day, Jackie called Ted to thank him for that rebirth. And then, on Thanksgiving Day 2002, there was no call. At first, Ted thought nothing of it. Maybe Jackie'd felt as if he'd been thankful enough. And then he did think something of it. He called reporter Jimmy Smith, with whom he'd produced the story.
And we decided that we needed to check up on him. Probably just that he, you know, missed it on his calendar. But we discovered that Jackie had gone missing, that something had happened. And like he tried to tell me in the locker room that he had had that one slip.
Ted heard rumors. Maybe Jackie Wallace was back in New Orleans. When he went out on a story, the photographer would examine the faces of the men he saw in the street. While he was taking photos for a feature on a homeless shelter, Ted was especially vigilant. And he wasn't exactly sure why Jackie's disappearance so disturbed him.
What was my motivation? Was it about him or was it about me? Was it the fact that my story was now crushed?
Maybe not crushed, but maybe in vain. If Jackie Wallace was back on the street, how much good had Ted Jackson's photo done him? Ted had used the story of Jackie's recovery in his talks to school children. He wondered if now he should tell them what had happened, assuming he ever found out. Ted heard nothing about Jackie Wallace for a dozen years. He assumed that Jackie was dead, probably from a drug overdose. And then one night at a homeless shelter, he ran into a guy who said he'd seen Jackie. Ted did some digging, and he found an address in Harvey, Louisiana.
It was 4 years old. But, you know, the more you think about it, the more you think, well, why not go check it out?
In 2016, that's what Ted Jackson did.
I drove up. There was a man sitting in a plastic patio chair in the front yard doing nothing in particular. I walked up, and I knew I was going to sound like a cop. So I asked him if he knew where I might find an old friend. And he looked up, he looked me over really good, and he said, and who would that be? I said, his name is Jackie Wallace. And he looked me up again, and he said, it's the door on the right. And just when he said that, the door opened, and Jackie walked out. And he yelled, he said, what are you telling that man about me? It was no doubt who he was. And so I went walking towards the door, and I said, are you Jackie Wallace? And he said, who wants to know? And I said, Jackie, when I tell you who I am, you're going to smile. And I said, I'm Ted Jackson. And his face just broke into the biggest smile. He shoved the door open and just swamped me in a bear hug.
Except when he'd imagined his friend was dead, Ted hadn't been wrong about where Jackie Wallace had been. At about the time that Thanksgiving call hadn't come, back in 2002, Jackie had had a fight with his wife. A night later, he was sleeping under a bridge.
Went straight back to homelessness. His drug addiction was worse than before. Had a lot of debt to the drug dealers that he had to deal with. So he started writing bad checks. He was arrested and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And he served three and got out on good behavior and went straight back to using again.
It was under those circumstances, Ted says, that Jackie decided to kill himself.
And walked up on the bridge, on the Crescent City Connection Bridge here in New Orleans, and was ready to jump off. And he said something stopped him. He doesn't know what it was. He thinks it was a cold wind hit him in the face. It just scared him. And he thought he was crazy. And he turned around, walked back down, and asked to be committed.
Fortunately, the doctors from whom Jackie sought help didn't buy his diagnosis. They told him he wasn't crazy, or at least he didn't have to be. They told him he was an addict. Jackie went back into treatment. When Ted found him up in Harvey, Jackie had been clean and sober for 3 years. Together, they attended a Narcotics Anonymous meeting at which that achievement was recognized. Ted recalls how the fellow leading the group that night addressed the former Super Bowler.
He said, you know, Jackie, you're still a star, but in this room, you're still an addict. And that was a powerful slap in the face to me. I thought, now that's kind of cruel. But I looked straight at Jackie, at his face, and he was shaking his head. Yep, you're right. You're right. When he gave Jackie his medallion at the end of the meeting, which was probably about an hour and a half, I'm guessing, you know, it seemed like a Lombardi trophy presentation. That's what the room felt like. Quite a moment for Jackie, and cheers and photos and everything else.
It was not surprising that the life Jackie Wallace had led had beaten him up. Even a short football career will do that, and living on the street is hard on a body. Shortly after he got that medallion, Jackie went into the hospital for a hip replacement. Surgery and recovery meant painkillers. Ted hoped for the best. Meanwhile, back in New Orleans, he was updating that Jackie Wallace story.
There was one loose thread in my story and in my relationship with Jackie. When we sat down for our interviews, he kept saying that he wanted another print of him sleeping under the bridge to hang on his wall. He had lost that during his travels and, you know, adventures in homelessness. And so I was excited about that. I made the print 16 by 20. I framed it myself, signed it. I wrote a little note on it.
Then Ted began calling Jackie to see when he could come over with the print. When the calls weren't returned, he started texting. No luck.
And so finally I texted one more time and I said, Jackie, I want to drop this print off to you. Can I drop it by now? And he wrote back, almost instantly, he said, "Can you mail it to my girlfriend?" And then gave me the address. And I said, "Well, you know, that'd be great, but I'd rather drop it by myself. I'd like to see you." And then I just asked the simple question, "Are you okay?" And he responded, "No."
Ted drove to the address Jackie'd given him. The woman who opened the door was surprised to see him, would have been surprised probably to see anybody who'd been connected with Jackie.
And she said, "What is this? And why would he tell you to leave it with me? We broke up." And she said, "Jackie's gone back to using again."
He'd left everything behind, including the medallion he'd been so proud to receive.
And I stood there stunned. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. But then she said, "Maybe this picture is the very thing that'll bring him back." And promised she would somehow get it to him. And then we'd see where it goes.
Let's see where it goes. It's about all Ted Jackson had at that point and what he'd hoped would be a story about how a guy saved himself, reclaimed his life. And Ted says he'll hold on to that hope until an obituary stamps it out.
Every time the phone rings, I think it might be Jackie. And every text I get, I think it might be him. And I'm very encouraged. I can say that. And I do expect it to be a very positive outcome when it's all said and done.
You can link to Ted Jackson's story on Jackie Wallace and see that photo of Jackie sleeping under the bridge at onlyagame.org. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at onlyagame.npr. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, hey, maybe we'll finally tell you about the prison marathon we first promoted during the closing days of the McKinley administration. But now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I can hardly wait, Bill.
March Madness is underway. President Trump has declined the opportunity to fill out a bracket in each of the last two seasons, but 38% of Americans apparently think that he should fill one out. I mean, why not? What could be the harm, right?
Well, I mean, how would you like to be the team he picks to win the national championship? Of course, I've got no room to talk about anybody's brackets this year since I picked Arizona to win the national championship.
Oops.
A major oops.
The UConn men's team failed to make the tournament this time around. Connecticut fired the head coach, Kevin Ollie, a week ago. Gino Auriemma, the coach of the spectacularly successful UConn women's team, was asked if he thought he could succeed on the men's side, and he says, "I have no interest." Is that just humility on his part?
There's absolutely no reason why Gino Auriemma needs that headache. He's got the most dominant team in college sports right now.
That's right.
And he's had it for what seems like a decade now. Why does he need the hassle of trying to bring UConn men's basketball back?
Excellent point. Men really do like the NCAA basketball tournament, Charlie. We know that we can be even more sure of that than ever before because of our friends in the field of urology. Wait, what?
Yeah, there seems to be a one hesitates to use the word upsurge, but I'll use it anyway, in vasectomies.
People get vasectomies just before the tournament so they'll have an excuse to stay home and watch it, right?
I mean, that makes sense to me.
Not to me.
Well, I mean, you know, it's all you need is like, you know, a little bag of frozen peas and the remote control.
LeBron James has doubled down on the proposition that he's playing the best basketball of his career, Charlie. This week he said, "I'm like fine wine. I get better with age." Any sense of what simile he may come up with next week?
Well, I'm sure he's thinking about why he shouldn't be tight as a drum or something. I mean, he's got a lot of money. He can afford to buy better cliches.
For the record, I found LeBron's comments to be bold and piquant, albeit coy and just a little presumptuous. How about you?
I thought they traveled very well.
NBC Sports Network experimented a bit with its Wednesday night broadcast of a game between the Rangers and the Penguins. The network decided to place a well-known Hollywood figure in Pierre Maguire's customary spot between the benches, and it sounded like this.
Whoa, oh.
Crosby with 6 goals, 10 points in his last six. Deflected!
Oh!
Look!
Oh, my God. chaotic down there, isn't
that
it, Susan?
That was crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Any guesses about the identity of that celebrity guest analyst?
Well, it's not Scotty Bowman, I'll tell you that. Actually, it was Susan Sarandon.
Yes, it was. It was.
Who was taking a bit of a break from being a know-nothing political commentator to being a know-nothing hockey commentator.
Well, we're going to hear a little more of her commentary right now. Here it comes.
In the beginning, the lights and everything was crazy. It was like being with the Rockettes. People going in and out, being just crazy. I love it.
I don't know about you, Charlie. I always have found some similarity between the New York Rangers and the Rockettes.
No, certainly back in the old days, there was a lot of kicking.
The Ukrainian government has banned their athletes from competing in Russia. Their rationale is that, quote, aggressors and offenders must be expelled from the global sports arena. Are we likely to see any of the teams that have qualified for the World Cup following in Ukraine's lead?
No, but the royal family in England has declared that they're not going because of the, you know, obvious assassination attempt on the Russian spy in Salisbury, England. Mm-hmm. And no diplomats from Great Britain are going either.
Charlie, the Baltimore Orioles have instituted a program called Kids Cheer Free. Every fan who buys a seat in the upper deck at Camden Yards can get 2 free tickets for their kids. Now, my kids are 31 and 28. Do you suppose I can still take advantage of this deal?
Oh, I think absolutely. There's no age limit on it that I can tell.
Baseball is, of course, under some pressure to appeal to a younger crowd, gather a younger fan base, so maybe this is something other major league teams will pick up on.
Well, I mean, it's very old school. I mean, it's almost the knothole gang from way back in the day.
Finally, Charlie, the Providence men's basketball team earned a tournament berth, and will you agree with me that for fans who are easily frightened or prone to nightmares, that's perhaps not such a good thing?
Yeah, it's become a real cult thing now. The Providence Friar, the big balloon-headed mascot, is a very terrifying-looking friar.
He is.
I mean, this is a Savonarola, you know, Torquil Marta friar. This isn't Friar Tuck. This is an evil burn-you-at-the-stake-if-you're-a-Templar friar.
Nobody expects the Inquisition.
Nobody expects the Providence Inquisition. But, of course, Providence lost its first game in the tournament, so the friar will go back, the demon friar will go back to hell where he belongs.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me, of course, each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Athletes have been known to pair up and go on to great effect. Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris did it. So did Karl Malone and John Stockton. And when Venus and Serena Williams play doubles, they're unstoppable. Only a Game's Karen Given has another story of an impressive duo, but this one comes to us from the research labs at Brandeis University.
To understand the friendship between Michael Rosbach and Jeff Hall, it's best to start with one very famous baseball game in the fall of 1975. Here is Michael Rosbach.
You want the short, medium, or long version?
Long, always long.
Long version, right. It was my first year at Brandeis. Jeff Hall, so he started a few months before I did.
When we first met, I realized almost immediately that we were kind of simpatico.
That's Jeff Hall.
Michael was working on nucleic acids, DNAs and RNAs, and I was working on genetic variants in Drosophila.
Drosophila, you and I might say fruit flies.
And so our professional interests overlapped. It all comes under the broad heading of genetics.
Hall and Rosbach liked a lot of the same things.
Pop music, beer drinking, profanity, misbehavior, and we were looked upon askance by the more sophisticated tweed jacket-wearing professor types.
The other thing that set Hall and Rosbach apart was their love of sports, which brings us to the fall of 1975 and that famous game. The Red Sox started that season as a long shot, even to make the playoffs. But come October, they faced the Cincinnati Reds in the World Series. Michael Rosbach entered the lottery for tickets and won the right to purchase 2 seats for Game 6 at Fenway Park. By the time the game came around, the Sox were down 3-2. But still, hopes were high.
So Jeff and I went down to see the game. It was rained out.
It rained for 3 days straight.
So finally, they played the game. We're in the bleachers.
God, we were so enthusiastic when the Red Sox went ahead early.
But in the fifth, the Reds tied it up. Then they went ahead by two in the seventh.
But I remember when you're starting to try to get your research going, it's not easy to do and wasn't going very well. So we weren't in a very good frame of mind. And now it was made it even worse because I said, my God, that looks like I'm going to lose this game. And then finally, I'll never forget, in the top of the eighth inning, this flat, mediocre non-entity for the Cincinnati Reds came to the plate.
His name was Cesar Geronimo. He won the Gold Glove that year, and he was a decent hitter, too.
And he hit a long line drive down near the pesky pole into the stands to make it 6-3. Michael and I looked at each other and said, it's over.
It'll be too painful to see the Red Sox lose. And so we just couldn't do it. And so we got up and left.
Just stormed out.
They're hanging by their fingernails right now.
Rossbach and Hall got in their car and drove west toward the Brandeis campus.
And as we were driving home, listening to the game on the radio,
Carbo hits a high drive.
Bernie Carbo knocked in a 3-run homer for the Sox.
The game was hanging in the balance, 6-6.
Dick Stockton, what can you say?
And then we watched on TV at home through the extra innings.
And there were all these remarkable extra inning plays. One of the announcers, he was commenting on all the tension and drama, and he said,
this crowd has been up and down and up and down. They're going to be drained. Nobody, obviously, has left the ballpark. The pitch.
I turned to Jeff and said, I beg to differ.
Any true sports fan knows what happened next.
If it stays fair.
In the bottom of the 12th, Carlton Fisk hit a home run off the left field foul pole. Red Sox win. There would be a seventh game of the 1975 World Series.
This is perhaps the greatest World Series game ever. And we had left.
What can I say? We're idiots. And we spent the whole next week telling everyone what happened to us because, you know, this is a scientific commitment to honesty. So we couldn't just say, oh, yeah, it was great. No, we had to say, no, I got something to tell you.
7 years would pass before Rossbach and Hall's dual loves of science and sports would collide again in a big way. This time it happened on the basketball court. Here's Hall.
But Michael has told a story about how the reason we got into research was via pickup basketball games. And that's a bit overstated.
The year was 1982. Rossbach and Hall were in the habit of playing pickup basketball games at the gym at Brandeis. They'd play with other professors and grad students and with a group of workers from the phone company. And after those games in the locker room, well, here's how Rossbach remembers it.
Well, let me put it this way. On Monday morning, the AT&T guys would often discuss in graphic detail their exploits, their dates from the weekend.
Rossbach and Hall sat one row over in the locker room, and their conversations often concerned genetics. Remember, Jeff Hall's research had to do with fruit flies.
Fruit flies have an elaborate courtship ritual. The male sings a song to the female.
So while the AT&T guys talked about human mating rituals, Rossbach and Hall would discuss the mating rituals of fruit flies. Jeff Hall was fascinated by research he learned about while doing his postdoc at Caltech. It had to do with fruit flies and the circadian rhythms that regulate sleep-wake cycles. But Rossbach says nobody understood what mechanism actually kept that biological clock running. He compares it to not understanding how a watch works.
What is the quartz crystal? Or if you like, you know, what are the gears? How are the gears connected together?
During those locker room conversations, Jeff Hall would bring up this research. He thought it was time someone did something with it. Michael Rossbach felt like he knew how the research could be moved forward.
I said, you know, we should really clone this gene, Jeff. We do this in our lab, and I think if we collaborate, I think we could make some progress here. He said, I agree.
Rossbach and Hall identified and sequenced the gene that regulates circadian rhythms in fruit flies. They figured out how that biological clock worked. And then came the really fortunate discovery. The same gene was at work in humans, which meant the research could be applied to studying and solving human sleep disorders.
It could have been that the fruit fly would have a different mechanism. You know, the fruit fly would have a analog clock and humans would have a quartz crystal and then nobody would give a damn about the fruit fly clock. Yeah, I want you to know that I'm scrupulously avoiding curse words that I think might be poorly viewed.
Rosbash and Hall's last major discovery was made in 1999. A decade later, their work began to gain recognition.
The first prize we won in 2009, when I got the phone call, I actually didn't know what the nature of the prize was, and I was rapidly Googling as I was saying, oh, how wonderful, thank you very much, and so forth and so on, not wanting to appear to be an idiot.
It was the Gruber Prize. It comes with an unrestricted cash award of $500,000. By then, Hall had retired to a cabin in rural Maine.
And I said, Michael, you don't need it. You're a highly paid employed person. I'm an unemployed, zero paid person. I need the money.
Last October, Michael Rosbash received another call, and this one needed no explanation.
I knew when I went to bed that night that the next morning was the prize, but we'd been several years since we had won anything, so I had, and my wife said to me that night as we went upstairs, she said, forget it. You guys are toast. It's over.
The phone rang at 5:10 a.m. Eastern, midday in Sweden.
And they woke me out of a deep sleep, which is also not great for your physiology.
Michael Rosbash and Jeffrey Hall, along with Michael W. Young, who independently pursued similar research at Rockefeller University, had been awarded the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine.
I was absolutely thunderstruck. I was a bit, at a loss for words for equilibrium. I thought, holy Now I said it, right?
Jeffrey Hall was even more surprised to receive the news. The man on the other end of the line apologized for calling before dawn.
And I said, well, this is going to be pathetic. I'm old. Old people tend to go to bed early and get up early. I had been up for an hour. I don't want to get up at 4 a.m, but I do.
Michael Rosbash admits that over the years, he's embellished the story of his locker room conversations with Jeffrey Hall. That academic commitment to honesty gets old after a while. But if not for sports, would the two have embarked on the research that brought them the Nobel Prize?
We were very good friends. If we hadn't played basketball, we would have had the conversation in a pub or over coffee in the lab. It's poignant, poetic, if you like, for two sports-obsessed faculty members to have had the conversation in that venue. You know, it's nice for us, but I think it would have happened anyway.
That story was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Souza. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Jeff Hall, who remembers two other things he and Michael Rosbash enjoyed together: playing pickup softball games and quoting Mel Brooks movies.
And Michael was weaving under a pop-up, and he kept yelling, I got it! I got it! I got it! And then the ball dropped at his feet, and he said, I ain't got it.
Yeah, I can identify. Took one of those pop-ups right in the eye one afternoon. The good old days. I hope they never come again. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.